Howdy, y'all. This is Rich Outfield, and you're listening to Vermont's country leader, KBUK. Here on the Buck, we got Waylon Jennings, we got Travis Tritt, we got Hank Williams, Jr. and Sr. We got Randy Travis, we got the man in black himself, Johnny Cash. And coming up now, right now, we got A Sidekick's Journey by Rich Outfield, the second part. Of course, this is the second part of the Sidekick Chronicles, follow-up to the CMA-winning album, A Birth of a Sidekick. After this, we've got to sell some Reba McEntire, so don't go far. Enjoy, y'all.
Six. She arrived on a Sunday. Ben had no church clothes, and though Ms. Aubrey allowed him to use her washing board, his school clothes were in a pile beside his bed, in need of a river, if not soap and a scrub. It was overcast and due to rain soon, although it didn't rain nearly as often in that part of Arizona as it threatened to. Ben was sitting on his windowsill, one leg in and one leg out, looking down as the cowpokes rode or walked into town to visit the tavern or the hospitality houses. The occasional latecomer to church went by in the opposite direction, and Ben wondered which he would choose if he was forced to pick. He believed in God, having spent nearly every day of his life around dedicated Catholics, but he also found church to be a chore, a drudgery to be tolerated rather than enjoyed. He worried that made him a sinner, but he didn't have anyone to talk to about it here in town. The Mexican priest he had visited that week was out of town most of the time, probably visiting various iglesias in nearby villages. Pastor Stevenson ran the little congregation at the church house on the south end of town, and he had a showy, theatrical way of talking that was more enjoyable, and understandable, than the father at the orphanage had been, especially since his masses were in English rather than a mix of Spanish and Latin. Ben didn't know the pastor, and was uncomfortable talking to him. What if he asked the man, and was browbeaten the way the hermanas used to do, reminding him that all boys were dirty, and he was worse than most for having questioned God's will? So Ben sat instead, practicing his penmanship on a writing slate, glancing out from time to time. One of these glances showed him a young man wearing a serape, riding a speckled mare, a gray donkey following close behind. The rider had a rifle at his hip and wore a black cowboy hat with some sort of mosquito netting attached to it. As the rider got closer, Ben realized three things. That it was a veil, not netting. That some of that veil was curly brown hair. And that the young man had breasts. Someone whistled. The rider turned her mare in the direction the sound had come, and Ben saw a second rifle on the woman's other hip. A moment later, a drunk, one of the big men that put up fences between here and the Triple J Ranch, sauntered towards the woman on the horse. He said something Ben couldn't make out and clapped his hands. The woman's posture was rigid in her saddle, and the way she held her shoulders, Ben could be forgiven for mistaking her for a man. The big drunk stepped closer to her, saying, "Maybe I can help you out." And then the man froze in his tracks. He tipped his hat to her, which was odd, considering his head was bare, and backed away, turning and disappearing the way he'd come. As far as Ben could tell, she had said nothing to the man, nor made any move or gesture. She turned her mare again in his direction, and Ben saw the wind push the veil she wore back down tight against her face. She was veiled like a lady at a funeral. Ben pulled his leg up into his room and stood. Maybe she wore a veil because she was mourning her great love and had just heard about his unfortunate demise. Lorelei Scruggs. Of course, she could have been anybody. A schoolmarm. A distant relative to the barman or shopkeeper. A mail-order wife for a ranchman, or a new prostitute for Juanita's. But the look of those two rifles, right there where she could grab one and fire it with no hesitation or fumbling. That reminded Ben of Senor Cook. And hadn't he speculated that Scruggs was the lady version of the lean rider? Ben got down the stairs and out into the street in less than a minute, not bothering to put on his shoes, and nearly ran into the donkey that was stopped outside Ms. Aubrey's door. The woman had dismounted her mare and was holding a handful of oats up to the horse's mouth. Ben had tried hand-feeding pony once and gotten bitten hard on the thumb, but this horse somehow ate the oats and left the skin untouched. The woman cocked her head and turned her veil toward Ben. She had long, untied brown hair, but except for the bottom of her neck and the top of her breastbone, none of her was visible. "You him?" she asked, her tone curt and all business. "Ms. Scruggs?" Ben asked back, and she snorted. "Guess you're him." Her voice was lovely, with no easily identifiable accent. The kind of voice he imagined his mother, or the Virgin, he supposed, would have. "Guess you're her," he said back, though he was certainly intimidated by this faceless woman. The cloth of her veil was semi-transparent, but he could only make out the shape of her face behind it. It was strange how much he'd come to depend on people's eyes, telling him their mood and intentions. To see nothing was unnerving. "I'm Ben Parks. You got my letter?" "I did." "You've got neat handwriting. I nearly expected to find a little girl here in Truneo." Ben found that odd, since he'd just been practicing his penmanship mere minutes before. "I thought you'd write back," he said.
"I did,"
Scruggs said.
"Guess it hasn't got here yet. Somebody told me it's 70 miles to the nearest telegraph office. Otherwise I'd..."
Ben didn't know how he'd ever get a message that way. He'd never seen a telegram machine, though he'd handled the occasional letter sent that way, usually for Father Puente at San Domingo's. The veiled head looked up and down the street. On one end, an old couple were walking toward church. On the other end, a man was urinating against the doctor's office.
"Booming place," she observed. "Looks like July 4th came early."
Ben squinted. Beyond the peeing man, two dogs chased each other in the dirt.
"Well, it's Sunday. That's the Sabbath for most folks." "Not for you. Didn't you come from the Sidekick factory?"
"The what, ma'am?"
"Santo Dominic's, or whatever the orphanage is called."
"Oh, right," Ben said. I did. I was. "Have you known a lot of Sidekick orphans?"
"A handful. They're usually either polite or bashful, or angry at everything, especially a lady friend of the rider's."
Ben pondered the term lady friend. It could mean several things.
"You are like him, right? You have adventures and bounties and missions and such?"
"Yes, I suppose I am."
"Would..."
Ben began, then stifled it. He just didn't know how to ask.
"Did you come to pay your respects to Senor Cook?"
"I did,"
the woman said. Without seeing her face, he couldn't tell if she was friendly, smiling, inviting, or sad, angry, or annoyed with him.
"Thanks for letting me know."
Ben nodded. He figured she'd want to see the grave, maybe lay a flower there. Could be she'd let him ride her donkey.
And,
he began, then again went silent.
"Spit it out, boy. Is it my face?"
"What? No, I was... In the letter I asked if you would help train me. Teach me to ride, rope, shoot, track."
"I read the letter,"
Scruggs said, her tone unreadable. Ben was again frustrated, wishing she would just spell out whether she'd help him or not. Finally, she huffed and said,
"Kid, I'm here, ain't I?"
He nodded, relieved.
"I can pay you."
"How? I thought you were an orphan."
"I am, but Senor Cook died, and, well, some of that money went to me."
All of it, actually. Jerome Cook had had over $60 in his knapsack, shirt, and saddlebag. Plus, there had been a reward for the capture of the cattle rustler that had killed him. And, of course, Ben had had the rider's horse sold, though he felt strangely disloyal having done that.
"There a place to stay in this town?"
Scruggs asked.
"Yes, ma'am. A hotel? Boarding house? Maybe rooms to rent?"
"Is that what you do?"
"Uh-huh. Right here. I stay at Ms. Aubrey's rooms. She's nice. Has the mayor's brother in one room, me in another. Two rooms empty."
"All right. You have a schedule?" Ben didn't know what she meant by that.
"Do you work? Go to school? Or do we just get started now?"
The sky had grayed. It was about to rain.
"I don't have shoes on," he said.
The woman made a noncommittal sound. He took it as, "Do what you like." So he pointed upstairs and said,
"I'll go get some boots on."
Ben had to ask to ride the donkey, but they got out to the lean rider's graveside before the first raindrops fell. Scruggs peered at the ground, still discolored from overturned earth, and Ben couldn't tell how upset she was. He had begun to ask her about the veil she wore, but the woman had immediately begun asking questions about the town, about Ben's place in it.
"They think Senor Cook left me here, that he'll come back some day to take me with him."
"A good story," she had said, "though you can't keep that up forever." Ben was well aware of that. It was partly why he'd written to her. They were ascending the ridge where the outlaw Segovia had built his campfire, and where Jerome Cook had died in the dirt. It reminded Ben.
"Ma'am, did you tell anybody about my letter? About what happened to him?"
"No one," she had said from her horse.
"You told me not to."
He had. Begged her not to, be exact. But he couldn't predict what she'd do based on one private letter he had read, even though he had read it over several times.
"So you and Senor Cook, you were in love?"
She made a noise. Could have been a laugh. Could have been a sigh.
"Not quite. He was interested in me, definitely. A lot of men were in those days."
She looked away from the grave and up at the horizon. The hills, the few trees, a crow flying low to the ground, looking for bugs or horny toads.
"Well, I certainly came around. Later. And in Cook's defense, he never brought up how I spurned him. More than once, in fact."
Ben didn't know what spurned meant. Was it what you did to get a horse moving faster?
"He was good at what he did," she said. "Not as good as the stories say he was, but he was good enough."
She turned to look at him. The raindrops had speckled the material of her veil, but they didn't make it any easier to see through.
"Did you know him long?"
"No, ma'am,"
Ben said quietly. He always spoke softly when he was in this place. By the grave of the man who shot Tobias King and nasty Wayne Matthews on the same day. It would have been great to hear that story, told by the only person who'd survived that confrontation. But Ben hadn't been in the man's company for a single week before death split them up. Not days, but hours.
"Not long. I'm sorry."
She put her hand out, in the air, as if catching the rain as it fell. It was still a pretty warm day, and the drops felt good as they came, though not enough to water any crops or turn sand to mud. Scruggs turned from the graveside.
"Were you... you were there when he went?"
"Uh-huh,"
Ben said, his eyes automatically darting to the brush and rocks where Cook had choked out his last.
"Did he suffer?"
she asked, then immediately added,
"Never mind, don't matter."
There was emotion in her voice, if not tears. Ben thought about it. Had he suffered? Certainly he was in great pain as he struggled to breathe through a mangled throat, but that ended quickly when the outlaw had shot him up close with his own gun.
"It was real fast,"
Ben said anyway.
"I had to go over it in my mind over and over again to even make sense of it."
That much was true. There had been the light of a campfire and a half moon to see by, not to mention the firing pistols.
How about Winnie? He dead too? Winchester,
Ben realized.
No, ma'am. The sheriff sold him. A man from Tennessee, I think.
Oh,
she said, glancing over at her own mare.
That sure was a smart horse.
Uh-huh,
Ben said, though the horse in the stories, who could communicate with his owner in a rudimentary way by snorting and shaking his huge head, was somewhat more impressive than the real one. Lorelei Scruggs said nothing for a while. The raindrops kept falling, landing on Ben's arms and head. But it was already letting up, as though God wasn't quite committed to it. Ben looked at the woman's clothes and forgave himself for thinking she was a man when he first glimpsed her. Her clothing, from hat to boots, were what cowboys wore, what Jerome Cook wore, though he had removed his duster as soon as they'd left the orphanage. There were threadbare spots on the pants and a tear on the collar of her shirt. The donkey had been carrying two largish bags, which they had left in Ben's room, and it appeared she'd been wearing the same clothes her whole journey west. She had a pistol and holster high up on her hip, which was mostly hidden underneath the duster she wore. He could see it now, though Ben didn't know firearms well enough to identify it. She saw him looking.
"Have you ever fired a gun, Ben Parker?"
No, ma'am,
he said.
And it's Parks.
Well, how did you subdue the criminal that night? The one who...
Ben knew who she was referring to.
I just pointed the gun. Told him I'd shoot. I guess he believed me.
Really? She looked him over, apparently not very intimidated.
You must have been awful mad.
Well, he was very drunk.
She unsnapped her holster and removed the pistol. It was a six-shooter. What he guessed was a Remington, and had seen a lot of use. She handed it to the boy, and he was surprised by its weight. He wondered if he'd ever get used to that. Pointing it and pulling the trigger, something like this could bring down a rattler, a bobcat, a wolverine, maybe even a cougar. 7. Or a cactus, apparently. After she'd gotten settled, Ms. Aubrey had seemed unwilling to rent her a room until she mentioned she had been sent by the lean rider to check on the boy. Scruggs had taken him out to the plane, and they faced some vaguely man-shaped cacti up on what the woman referred to as a hummock. She told him to sight in on the plant, closing one eye, and to squeeze the trigger, not jerk it, and he missed. And missed again. Scruggs sighed. He was closing the wrong eye. He tried again, still missed, but was closer this time. He actually hit a cactus the next shot, though not the one he was aiming at. His last shot might as well have been aimed straight up. Ben was going to complain that Senor Cook made it look so simple, but he'd never really seen the man shoot, just get shot.
Shooting looks so easy,
Ben said.
It is easy,
the woman said, removing the spent casings and reloading the pistol.
Hitting your target is a little harder.
She told him he just needed to practice, and said he was welcome to as many shells as he required, as long as he paid for them himself. How generous. She let him practice a dozen more times, and toward the end, he was just getting it, just understanding when to breathe and how to hold the gun steady. But of course, it was now the end of their lesson.
"Rifle's a little easier, kid," she said.
It was impossible to know if she was exasperated, understanding, or even impressed with him. Not yet.
"May I try it?" "Someday. Those cartridges cost more. Don't want to waste them."
But she did teach him how to read the horizon, how to scan the hills and ridges for where water would be most likely.
And where there's water, you can usually find something you can eat, even if it's a snake or a toad. "You've eaten toads?"
he asked. And when she nodded,
"How do they taste?" exactly the way you'd imagine, I'm afraid.
And she smiled. Maybe it was in the voice, or in the way she held her head, but he could sense a smile there.
All righty, time to call it a day. Tomorrow we'll make another go of it, okay? Yes, ma'am,
he said, and was more than a little excited.
How's your Spanish?
She asked.
Well, I understand it fine, ma'am, but... All right,
she interrupted.
You can teach me some, then. I don't speak a word. Be like school out on the prairie, for us both.
She glanced back the way they had come.
Pity I can't afford to stay here long enough for either of us to get very good. I've got some money in the bank, Ben said. But it's not open today. We could go tomorrow.
The woman shook her head.
You don't have...
But then she stopped. She made a small sound, maybe a sigh. Ben later came to recognize it as the sound of pride being swallowed.
I suppose that's best. Just a little, though. Money for a room. For cartridges. Not all you got.
Ben nodded. His inclination was to trust her, because she was an adult, and respect for adults had been pounded into his head all his life. The rainfall had stopped already, and there were long, straight rays of sunlight pushing down through the clouds. It was actually pretty magnificent. Lorelei Scruggs gazed out at the horizon, and Ben gazed at her, trying to glimpse beyond the veil.
What? May I ask a question, ma'am? Yep, you might as well get it out of your system.
So she knew what he was going to ask then.
You wear that veil because of Senor Cook, or for another reason? Can't it be both?
She asked, and the smile was still in her voice.
Young Ben Parks, I've worn this veil for going on 5 years now. You would think it would be to protect innocent women and children from a nasty shock, but...
Ben found himself leaning closer. Hadn't the drunk on the street in Trino acted shocked himself when she spoke to him?
But it's really for me, so I don't have to remember.
Ben was curious, but didn't want to pry. He was reminded of hermanas that came to San Domingos and would refer to bad times before they became brides of Christ, before they felt safe within the confines of the orphanage. The woman got up in the saddle, and Ben moved quickly to do the same, with Scruggs's donkey. She waited until he was ready, watching him behind her shield.
You know, kid, I hope you grow up strong and handsome, like Cook, she said. The kind of face that stops an argument, the kind of face that starts people going to church when they've strayed. I know what that's like, because that was me, just an eye blink ago. I was most comely, and it was not a bad feeling. But then I had my little accident, and all that changed.
She trailed off, and Ben wondered if he was supposed to say something. He wanted to, sure, but it seemed impolite. Finally, he decided to ask about the accident, but in a subtle way, as though he wasn't really that curious, and certainly not rude about it. But she continued without him.
The worst thing is, sometimes I forget. I wake up and be well into my day before I catch my reflection in a stream or notice something wrong with my shadow on a rock. And it all comes back to me. I'm not that girl anymore. The one what sent apostates back into the bosoms of their chapels, believing angels must be real.
She made a sound, a huff, but a more painful version.
I suppose I could still send a soul or two back there, if they take a nice gander. Except not because I look so much like an angel.
Ben felt strange hearing this. He'd felt the same way reading her letter, like he was looking at something he shouldn't be. But she was talking, and he might as well hear it all.
What... happened? You want to see Ben?
No, ma'am,
he said immediately. probably too quickly, too emphatically. He didn't want to pry. He didn't want to snub her. He wanted right in the middle.
"Good boy,"
she said, and he couldn't read her voice that time. It was all she had to say, for now. Ben managed better with the rifle. The sight was easier to line up, and he could balance it with both hands and his shoulder. He managed to hit a jackrabbit, though he wasn't sure he killed it. When Scruggs sent him to fetch the rabbit so they could eat it, he startled a skunk not far from it and, well, then it was time to go home. There were a pair of sisters just outside of town who ran baths for ranch hands coming to gamble or whore, and Ben availed himself of one of their tubs, even though the skunk spray had missed him by several feet. One of the sisters had soaked Ben's shirt and wrung it out so he could wear it back to Ms. Aubrey's. Lorelei Scruggs made sure he was decent, then stuck her head in the room where Ben was drying his hair.
"I think I can still smell it," she observed.
"Maybe that's you."
"Possibly. I did ride into town with some fool what tried to pick up a skunk."
He laughed, though she might not have been joking.
"Getting dark,"
Scruggs said.
"We ought to be going."
"Yes, ma'am."
"So, about our arrangement," she began. "You want me to talk to the sheriff or your teacher or someone?"
"The sheriff? Why?"
She faced him, unmoving.
"Because you're a kid."
Ben still didn't understand. The way she said "you're" instead of "your" gave just a hint of an accent, but Ben didn't know from where. At the orphanage, some of the nuns had spoken no English, and the ones that did insisted on a proper book-learned pronunciation, as though they were raising a bunch of future politicians. But here in Tueno, some spoke with a Texas drawl, some with a southern lilt, and some like city folks.
"Who's your guardian?"
she asked him. Ben thought of the saints, of the stories from San Domingo, and the ones that had resonated with him. Some of the Bible prophets and apostles had impressed him, but he fixated on Jerome Cook, the unofficial patron saint of the orphanage, and how, among all those boys, the writer had chosen him, had seen something in him, even if it was just that Ben would leap to grab a handkerchief when those beside him didn't.
"No one, ma'am."
"All right. Well, we can go out, try a few things, ride and shoot and track and hunt, and we go from there. Sound good?"
"Sound very good,"
Ben said, even though it came out wrong to his ears and probably wasn't proper English. To distract from it, he put out his hand for her to shake. She took it, and her skin was warm and smooth, like Ben's own, but her grip was strong, like a grown-up, like a man.
Eight. It was with no small measure of excitement that Ben handed Lorelei Scruggs two letters that he'd kept, addressed to the lean writer.
"What?"
she asked.
"Read that,"
he said, then added by habit,
"Please."
Her covered eyes went over the words. The first letter had been from a battered woman whose husband had become a stranger to her. She asked Jerome Cook for help in putting him back on the proper path.
"I don't understand,"
Scruggs said.
"You know this woman?"
"No, but she's in Mesa. She wanted help."
"Yeah, from Jerome Cook. She wanted somebody to thrash her husband for her."
"Oh."
Ben should have realized. He'd thought she wanted someone to talk to her husband. But in retrospect, she had said, "If only he knew the way I felt, the fear and shame, I'm sure he would set his house back to rights." Obviously, she wasn't talking about mere words.
"Kid, if you want to ride out to Mesa to give this man a whooping..."
"No," Ben said.
"I didn't..." "There's the other letter."
That one was about a family whose possessions were stolen right out from under them by some ranch hands, who happened to work for the marshal, who happened to own the ranch where the valuables, brought all the way from Denmark, now resided. The thieves flaunted their actions, and the family, whose patriarch was unwell, felt quite helpless.
There would be a reward if you could return our stolen property to us, for the items in question mean more in terms of familial history than mere money.
Scruggs looked up.
Reward, huh?
Ben nodded.
Well, they don't say how much, but we could... They're in Gunderson? How far is that?
I don't know,
Ben admitted. But he knew there was a big map of Arizona at the schoolhouse, and there were maps to be had at the sheriff's office. He told her so.
How is the sheriff here in town?
Ben didn't know what she was asking.
Is he friendly?
Yes, he used to be the friendliest man in town.
Is he friendly to strangers with their faces covered?
Again, Ben didn't know.
How about your landlord?
Is that like a mayor?
She sniffed.
Of the boarding house?
Oh, Ms. Aubrey. You want to know if he's friendly to her?
No, is she friendly?
Sure.
Well, I'll have a chat with Ms. Aubrey, and we'll see if we can't have ourselves a little adventure.
Their adventure turned out to be very small. Mostly it was like school, only outside. They went fishing. They shot guns. Ben was still much, much better with the rifle than a pistol, though he did manage to hit his target twice with the six-shooter. Twice in 18 tries. She showed him how to lay a trap with a rope to catch a pig, or fox, or coyote, or weasel, he supposed. She only complained about the heat about once every half hour or so. Ben felt frustrated at his inability to master any task. She made a lasso and threw it around a cactus, a rock, and Ben himself, not looking like it took any effort. Ben tried, but it wouldn't go where he wanted it. He could lasso sand, and that's about it. They rode their horses bareback, and she showed him the proper way to sit in the saddle, with his back straight and his legs hugging the sides of Pony, so he bounced less and kept a better center of gravity. He wanted to ask her if it hurt her as much as it did him, riding without a saddle like that. But she was a girl, so of course he didn't. As they rode across the plain, they startled about a million doves. They scattered through the air, flying in a dozen directions, but never seeming to hit each other. A larger bird circled overhead, brown or red. She glanced upward and asked if he knew what it was. He couldn't even identify a common western bird. It was a chicken hawk, turns out. She was looking in his direction, and he saw her blink underneath the veil.
What are you good at, Ben Parks?
What do you mean?
Why did Cook pick you?
Ben understood her question now, and he felt his ears begin to burn.
I caught his handkerchief.
Oh, said the woman. Well, that's a skill that's essential in our line of work.
That made him feel a little better. She went on.
You don't know how many times catching a kerchief saved my life out there on the Great Plains.
Really?
He asked, not sure if she was funnin' with him or not. She was funnin' with him. He remembered 2 months back, the first time he'd ridden with another person. The best moment of Ben's life had been riding out of the orphanage with the lean rider, the envy of every other boy burning a hole at his back.
This is it,
he'd thought.
I'm special. Somebody sees that in me.
But what if he wasn't special? What if he was as ordinary as any huérfano? He'd only gotten lucky, and for such a short time before it ran out. For Jerome Cook as well as himself.
How do you know it's a chicken hawk?
She angled her head back toward the bird.
Because of its bright red tail. A regular hawk's tail is brown.
All right. Thanks,
Ben said, steeling his shoulders.
Next time I'll know.
She didn't say anything to that, and he glanced over. At that moment, the wind took her veil, flashing the left side of her face. She was beautiful, with smooth skin and silky dark hair and lips like a... But she grabbed the veil tightly and secured it in place once again, slowing her horse and eventually stopping riding altogether. Ben rode on for a minute, getting pony to turn, after three tries, and head back to her. What was the situation then with Ms. Lorelei Scruggs? He had imagined she was ugly, or deformed, or had her face melted like the burned boy at San Domingo's, who had been with them so briefly Ben didn't even remember his name. So was it just a mourning veil, like a lady at a funeral wore? But hadn't she said she always wore it? Didn't she? It occurred to Ben that maybe Lorelei Scruggs thought she was ugly or deformed, when she was anything but. What did that make her? Crazy? Or just eager to be left alone by men, a woman traveling by herself in the great western frontier?
"Do you know a Mr. Collie?"
he asked as they rode north.
"Who's that?"
Scruggs asked.
"He's a Negro, friend of Senor Cook's. A kid, like you." "No, ma'am,"
Ben said, carefully phrasing his next comment.
"He's old, with a long scar on his neck. You know what I mean? A lynching scar?"
Ben didn't know what that was, and thought of lightning. Padre Puente often spoke about the rich man who thought he didn't need God's help anymore, and was struck by lightning.
"Y cuánto le ayudó su dinero en este momento?"
the priest had asked. "Oh, 70 times or so." You'd think it was a rhetorical question, asking how much the rich man's money had helped him, but he always wanted one of the boys to answer it.
"I don't know. He didn't say what happened to him." "To his face,"
Ben wanted to say, but he was just too polite. The black man had told his story, but that wasn't what Ben wanted to talk about. He wanted to know about her veil and what she thought it was hiding.
"Must be old man Coley," said Scruggs. "Jerome rode with a Negro in Michigan, or Mississippi, or Minnesota, one of those places. You don't know how Senor Cook saved him from angry whites?" "No, but that's not surprising. You're slouching in the saddle again, Benny. It'll wear your back out." "Yes, ma'am,"
he said, and resumed his more upright position on the pony. They kept riding, their shadows getting longer beside them and their mounts. Not much later, they reached a signpost along the trail. Tracy, 23. Valle Amarillo, 14. Gunderson, 6. Someone had scratched the word embrujado next to Tracy.
"Benny, what does embrujado mean?"
Scruggs asked Ben, who was lagging behind. He didn't know. So she spelled it.
"Oh."
He gave it some thought.
Like cursed by a witch, you know?"
She snorted, but said nothing more. When Ben got to the sign, he became excited.
"Only 6 more miles." "You up for another 6? "Oh, you betcha,"
he said, though he did ache a little around the spine. He wanted her to know he could suffer without complaining, that he was special and worth the effort to train him.
"I will have to make some water soon, though,"
he added. He'd had to go for over an hour, just didn't want to say anything.
"Tell you what, next prickly pear cactus you spot will be dismountain time." "Those are the kinds you can eat?"
he asked. She sighed, apparently not impressed with his retention. Mental, not the bladder kind. She'd only pointed out 6 different kinds of cactus,
including the kind owls made homes in, the kind you could drink from, and the kind that flowered the prettiest. As far as he knew, she'd never been to Arizona before, and yet she knew so much about the animal and plant life, the terrain, the likely spot for watering holes, tracks in the sand. He wasn't allowed to make water for 40 more minutes. 9. They reached the outskirts of Gunderson, Arizona. A pitiful place, with mud and a dark-watered river running right through it. It literally ran through town, if the ankle-deep mud in the main thoroughfare was any indication. "You know what quicksand is, boy?" Scruggs asked, her speckled mare's hoofs making obscene squelching noises as they went. To their left was a saloon identical to Trueno's lesser one, and several cheaply built wooden structures Scruggs told Ben were a kind of apartment. A child ran toward them, its hand outstretched, so mud-covered and filthy that it could have been a boy or a girl. The child said a word in a strange tongue, then slipped and fell, chest first, into dirty black mud. Ben gasped, immediately concerned, but the dirty child actually laughed and rose to his, her, feet again, saying something else, and then,
"Money?"
holding up a brown-covered hand.
"You know the Jesperson family here in town?" Scruggs asked. "They raise pigs?"
"Yeah, yeah, pigs!"
laughed the child, and made a squealing sound that was pretty darn close. The kid wiped mud off its chin, eyeing the veiled woman curiously.
"What happened to your face?"
Benny's ears perked up at the impolite question.
"I played in too much mud as a little girl, I'm afraid."
The child's eyes widened just a bit more, and then she, Ben got a female vibe from her, stomped on toward home. In one of the windows above the saloon, a heavy-set older woman sat smoking. Scruggs tilted a hat at her, like a cowboy would.
"Ma'am, I'm looking for the Stig Jesperson place."
"What fur?"
the woman asked, not moving. Scruggs indicated Ben beside her.
"Gonna leave my boy with him."
Ben swallowed. He was pretty sure it was a lie, but the thought was not a pleasant one. The heavy woman grunted and pointed a large arm to the south.
"They live about a half mile down the road. Big farm. You'll smell it before you see it."
"Pig farmers?"
Ben asked.
"Oh, yeah."
She grinned, only a few brown teeth left in her mouth.
"You'll get used to it. After a year or so."
"Thanks for the directions," Scruggs said, and signaled her horse to keep moving.
"Somebody die?"
asked the large woman. Ben urged Pony to start moving too, trying to catch up with Scruggs. The large woman stood up then, leaning out toward them.
"I say, what happened to your face?"
"Fell out a window,"
Lorelei called back, but didn't turn. Other folk watched them through the doors of their shops or the windows of their homes, but it was a dirty day to be out and about. True enough, the Jesperson farm could be smelled before it could be seen. It was a strong, sweet odor, and it started out as animal feces, but mixed with rotten food as they got closer.
"You gonna be sick, kid?"
asked Scruggs.
"I... no," he said,
hoping it didn't get worse.
It did,
but by then, Ben's nose had started to get accustomed to it. The Jesperson farm was a sprawling estate, a noisy, snorting, squealing, wallowing estate, with two buildings on it, a ramshackle homestead, and an even more ramshackle slaughtering barn. There were noises coming from the barn right now that sounded like a sinner's worst nightmare. If any preacher could replicate that shrieking and intimate that it came from hell, whole congregations could be saved.
"What is that?"
Ben mumbled.
"It's how we get pork chops, honey."
The pig pens, multiple, were fenced off, but looked as though they would collapse at any moment, filling the valley with sows, hogs, and piglets. Lorelei Scruggs dismounted, a feminine gesture like a dance step, and Ben surprised himself by admiring her grace. He tried the same thing, and ended up knocking his head against the back of Pony's mane, then flopping to the ground on his knees. There was mostly rock there rather than mud, so that was a bright side, though it did hurt.
"You okay?"
Scruggs muttered, and Ben pulled himself to his feet with a nod. A little girl, maybe 6, came out of the homestead with a water bucket and stepped toward the water pump before seeing the pair of horses and 2 strangers.
"Mama! Papa! Visitors!"
called the girl. Ben didn't see how the child could carry a full bucket, but it didn't matter. The little girl, blonde, plump, pleasant-faced, wound her way around the pens that made up the entirety of the front yard and rapped on the clumsily installed wooden door of the slaughterhouse.
"More!"
she shouted, Danish, but obviously to her mother. A moment later, a woman came out the door, a frown on her face, and a jugular's worth of blood on her body and clothes. Ben gasped and heard a similar sound from Lorelei Scruggs.
"Hello!"
called the woman. She wore a scarlet-stained apron and dripping gloves, and a round, motherly face like her daughter.
"Could I be helping you?"
She spoke with a lilting, sing-song accent Ben had never heard before, though it was a more colorful version of the mud child's accent in town.
"Yes,"
Lorelei said, having to shout above the din of the army of pigs. Perhaps 100, perhaps twice that.
"We come looking for Stig Jespersen?"
"Stig!"
called the woman, and a phrase in Danish. After another moment, her husband emerged, a thin older man with a gray beard and a meat cleaver the size of Pony's head. He, too, had a bloody apron on, with red splattering his arms and beard.
"Family business,"
Ben heard Scruggs say.
"Hello to you,"
called the man. He also smiled, though his eyes looked wary.
"You needing the directions?"
"Maybe,"
Scruggs replied, shouting over the squeals and snorts all around them. At least the screaming from the slaughterhouse had ceased.
"We've come on behalf of Jerome Cook."
"To have to cook it?"
Jespersen asked. His wife translated for him. She didn't say Jerome Cook, though, but Lean Rider.
"Ah,"
said the man, his eyes scanning the horizon.
"Lean Rider, come to visit house."
"No, he..."
began Scruggs, then stopped. They hadn't rehearsed what they would say during their journey. But Ben had rehearsed it plenty. He called,
"Mr. Cook is on a special mission for the government, in Montana, but he sent us here for him."
"He getting my letter?"
asked Mrs. Jespersen.
"Yes,"
Ben called, but Scruggs put up her hand.
"Is there any place we can talk?"
Mrs. Jespersen said something to her husband, who shouted at the little girl who had filled the bucket at the pump and, amazingly, was able to drag it using both hands to her father's feet. Mrs. Jespersen told them to follow their daughter, Nesse, inside.
"We clean up. Meet inside also."
10. Inside was relatively cleaner, relatively mud-free. There was a table, only 3 chairs, and 2 small beds in the same room. There were no windows, only pinned-up sheets covering the spaces, and 2 half-full buckets sat on the floor to collect rainwater from the roof. Ben wondered briefly why the girl had to collect water from a well when there was plenty already inside the house. While this was a step up from the San Domingo orphanage, it was less than Benny had back at Miss Aubrey's, and he was just one small person.
"We have little to offering," said Mrs. Jespersen, smiling. "Would you caring for some ham?"
She still had speckles of blood in her hair and on her forehead, a scattering of dark freckles on her neck and ear.
"No, thank you," Scruggs said. "We got your letter, but rather... Mr. Cook got it,
and sent it our way.
He off doing good for others?
asked Mr. Jesperson, peering rather rudely at Lorelei's veil.
He your friend?
Yes. We worked together,
she quickly amended. Work together often. Mr. Jesperson said something in his language, under his breath, maybe. His wife, whose English was better, but still left a lot to be desired, added,
We meet Mr. Leanrider when we are coming across to West. He help our family with, how you say it, Indian men who are bothering us.
Mr. Jesperson made a finger across the throat gesture and smiled at the boy.
Really?
Ben couldn't help but say. The wife smiled too.
Yes, he is friend to the Jesperson family.
At once, Ben felt jealous of them.
What harrowing and entertaining adventures had he shared with Jerome Cook? Oh, the tales he could tell of tying a damn knot with a length of horsehair.
How you knowing him?
The man asked Lorelei, still staring unashamedly at her face, or lack thereof.
Well, you see,
said Scruggs,
my father was the governor of Arkansas, and some unruly characters thought they could gain some leverage if they took me hostage, right before the next election.
Ben's eyes widened. He knew this story. Lorelei Scruggs told the famous tale of how Jerome Cook infiltrated the gang of the governor's opponent and ended up actually placed as one of the guards in the mill where they were keeping her. Cook beat up two, shot one, and when Thomas C. Thompson, the conniving candidate, which is how he'd been referred to in the magazine story, came to check on his prisoner, or do Lord knows what to her, he found only his own men there, including one who'd bled to death and soiled himself, making the others quite uncomfortable, believe you me. Ben hadn't read that particular detail in the story, but it delighted him, and the Jespersons, when Lorelei told it.
"And you, father, he win the voting?"
asked Mrs. Jesperson.
Indeed he did. Two more terms. Oh, very good.
Oh, very good,
said both Danes, one after the other.
And,
said Mr. Jesperson softly,
they hurt you face.
I,
began Lorelei, then lowered her covered head as if in shame.
My husband not mean cruel words,
said Mrs. J.
We is sorry. That's quite all right,
Lorelei said and raised up proudly.
So, if you'll tell us the problem, we'll be happy to help you in your predicament.
The pair explained that Stieg had been a reverend back in Denmark and had been hoping to set up a church here in America. But the mayor's son, Dallas Girk, had stolen their chest of valuables right off their wagon, including a golden cross that had been in the family since 1781.
And now you're pig farmers, Reverend?
Asked Scruggs.
Well, we have always be pig farmers,
the man said with a shrug.
But now that is all I being.
If you give us a description of what was taken, and directions to this Girk's place, we would be happy to investigate.
Ben thought that was a good move, and practiced his penmanship writing the list on a newspaper sheet, also lightly spattered with blood, the Jespersons gave him.
What are...
began Stieg, but his wife interrupted him.
You leave your son with us while you help? My son, I...
Scruggs sniffed.
No, I'll need him with me, in case they're shooting.
Mrs. Jesperson didn't respond to that, but Stieg cleared his throat.
What happened to your face, dear girl?
There was silence then in the ramshackle house, with the snorting of pigs outside the only noise.
I was in a fire,
Lorelei Scruggs said.
It's not very pleasant.
Oh,
said the man.
Very sorry hearing.
Ben wasn't sure what to make of it. He had seen her face,
at least part of it, for half a second when they were riding, and she looked fine. Better than fire would leave someone. He'd seen actual burn survivors at the orphanage. Often hair didn't grow back after something like that, and Lorelai's hands were smooth and unmarked.
"You show me, dear girl?"
Stieg asked, and his wife elbowed him in the side, like a bully back at San Domingo's.
"You mentioned a reward,"
Scruggs said, not responding to the invitation.
"We have pigs,"
Stieg Jesperson said, motioning. Ben felt a bit of disappointment at that, but he had expected to gain nothing from this outing, as the stories usually had the lean rider turn away any thought of earthly reward, unless it was a meal or a soft bed for the night. Mrs. Jesperson pointed to the newspaper, where Ben had listed the missing items.
"We have two candle holds. One is silver, one is gold. You may take one in thanks."
Mr. Jesperson didn't seem to agree with that, and said something negative in Danish. The woman responded sharply, their words fast and unintelligible. Stieg pointed to the list as well.
"A music box, no?"
The fourth item his wife had Ben list was Music Box with Dancing Angel. Mrs. Jesperson wasn't thrilled with that choice either, but after a quick conversation, nodded.
"You take one or the other."
"Thank you very much," Lorelai said, and stood up.
"We'll head over there right now."
"Thank you very much,"
parroted Stieg Jesperson. His wife offered them water from the pump, and they were back on their horses in 2 minutes. Mr. and Mrs. Jesperson were back in their barn just as quickly, before they were out of earshot. Ben had a lot of questions, but started with,
"You were the kidnapped daughter in The Lean Rider and the Crooked Candidate?"
"Nah," the woman said. "But Jerome told me that story 2 or 3 times. "It was a senator's daughter, not the governor's," Ben added. "You weren't there neither, kid," she said,
but there was a smile in her words. Ben was able to get back up on Pony on the first try and glanced over to see if Lorelai was watching. The smell of swine was less noticeable now, but Ben remembered how bad smells at the orphanage just became commonplace after a while and would only be noticeable once they'd gone outside for gardening or exercise.
"So what are you going to do?"
"Huh?"
Scruggs asked, glancing over.
"About the Denmarker's stuff?"
"I don't know," she said. "I'll go over and meet the guy, then decide what I want to do."
"Meet him how?"
"I was planning on knocking at the door and asking him."
Ben blinked. He urged Pony to go a little faster, trying to ride alongside Scruggs.
"Ask him for the stuff he stole?"
"Sure.
Unless you want to do it."
No, he said. No thanks.
Scruggs urged her mare to speed up, pulling ahead of Ben again.
"Jerome used to say, the only plan that works is to plan for the worst."
That made absolutely no sense. But what did Ben know?
"And if he tells you he doesn't have the stuff?"
"Oh, he's got it."
"How do you know? They could have been lying."
"Do you think they were lying?"
Ben thought about it.
"No, but sometimes there's more to the story than we hear."
The veiled head nodded.
"Okay, I'll ask this Dallas Girk for the stuff back. And if he's unwilling or has sold it off, then..."
"Then what?"
Ben asked.
"You'll shoot him?"
"That's what Jerome would have done."
"No, no, he always lets the bad guy make the first move, and only shoots if he's got no other choice."
"Right," she chuckled. "That's what those stories you read told you? Or did that lie come from Cook himself?"
"It always pays to be honorable," Ben quoted, "especially if you're the better shot."
"I've heard that before," Scruggs said.
"And remind me, how did that work out for Jerome Cook?"
Sadly, Ben couldn't argue with that.
11. It was late afternoon. The Girk farmstead was big and fenced off, and had cows and sheep, and absolutely no pigs. As they approached the property, a scrawny, sneering cowboy with the world's weakest mustache rode toward them, a yipping spotted dog at his feet.
"What's your business, lady?"
Ben was impressed the cowboy had recognized Scruggs as a woman.
"My son and I need to speak with Dallas Girk."
Her son. Ben felt something at hearing those words. Something unfamiliar, but nice. He hadn't been anybody's son in a long, long time.
"Oh, Dallas is sick," the cowboy said. He's got the consumption, old Doc says."
"And you are?"
"I'm feeling fine," he said.
"Are you a friend of Mr. Girk's?"
"Nah, I'm his cousin."
The little dog yipped again, and Lorelei's horse actually swiped a hoof at it. The dog fell silent. Concern and sincerity welled up from her voice.
"We need to talk to your cousin, young man. It's terribly important."
By this point, they had reached the fence around the property, and Lorelei was dismounting her horse. Ben did the same.
"Well," said the cowboy, "I can ask him, but he's ailing."
"Oh, I know," Lorelei stressed. "That's what we've come to talk to him about."
The cowboy nodded and jumped off the horse, as awkwardly as Ben would have, then moved quickly to the door of the homestead. Lorelei followed. Ben did too, the mongrel dog snapping at his feet and growling. The young cowboy walked right in and closed the door on the two visitors. Ben was nervous, remembering his last confrontation with a criminal.
"What should I do?"
he murmured.
"You have your pistol?"
Ben gaped. He didn't own a pistol. Was he supposed to have asked for one of hers?
"Then just stand back and look really worried." "Yes, ma'am,"
Ben said. He didn't think that would be difficult. And what next transpired was anything but difficult. A taller man wrapped in a blanket shambled to the door, moving like a sleepwalker, his eyes crusted with snot and circled in purple. He looked terrible, if not at death's door, then at least on its front porch.
"What?"
he growled, trying to master a bit of swagger, but ending up less threatening than the dog that still looked at Ben with suspicion.
"Are you Dallas Girk?"
Lorelei asked, and there was a tremor in her voice. Something about his appearance must have terrified her.
"My name is Latham, and this is going to sound very strange, but I promise you I'm life or death serious."
Girk shook his head slowly.
"Wah."
"I hail from Tulsa, my boy and me. We used to be four, but my husband and my sister, they already passed on because of the curse."
"Curse? What the hell are you talking?"
"There were these Danish folks passing through town toward the west. The old man was a preacher. He had some religious, what do you call them, artifacts he brought from Europe. My family ran the hotel where they stayed, and we took some of their things. A hymn book, a communion goblet."
The sick man shivered.
"I don't got..."
"They were cursed,"
Lorelei all but shrieked.
"All the things had been cursed by the witch Ophelia. Anybody who took them, who touched them, would have the most terrible sickness befall them."
Dallas Girk shook his head again.
"I don't think you..."
But then he began to cough.
"It's true,"
Lorelei insisted.
"My husband was first. He wasted away like an old woman what stops eating. He was like a skeleton before the end."
Her breath hitched in her throat.
"My baby girl, she turned green. She couldn't get any air, like she was choking, only it went on for days."
She actually sounded like tears were flowing. Girk wiped his mouth, his coughing having stopped.
"I didn't steal no..."
"You didn't?"
asked Lorelei, shoving past him, pointing to the row of items on the fireplace. There were two candlesticks, one silver and one gold, as well as a large ornate cross and a huge Bible.
What's all that, then?
That stuff's...
From the kitchen, the cousin stood up.
That stuff's ours. It ain't stolen.
Oh, no?
Asked Lorelei.
I suppose de Bidge Bell isn't in Dutch, then?
Look, you gotta leave,
said the cousin. But his eyes were twitchy, moving of their own volition toward the fireplace, as though it were a sleeping grizzly bear. Dallas Girk looked confused, looked scared, looked guilty. But mostly, he looked sick.
Mr. Girk,
Lorelei said, touching the man's dirty shirt.
Take a look at my boy. 2 days ago, he was a goner. Miserable, bone white, soiling himself till blood came out.
Yuck.
He was attracting every fly on our journey out here.
Ben tried to look unwell, but could only stand there stupidly, not quite sure he was seeing this, participating in this little farce.
But we got to the farm a ways back, where those good folks we stole from now live.
Pig farmers,
gasped Girk, leaning against the wall for support.
Yes, sir. We gave them back their belongings. And how fast did you get better, son?
I don't know, Mama,
Ben said.
I guess right the next day.
Oh, poor boy was out of his head. He didn't know day from night,
she said.
He got better right then, as soon as those objects were out of our possession. I only wish I'd gotten out here faster. We might all have been saved.
Girk looked from Ben to his mother, and Ben put on a grateful expression, sure this would all end badly. No one would fall for something like this, would they?
Look, lady.
Girk started, then began to cough again. It was that deep, wet kind of cough that looked like it hurt something awful.
It may not be too late for you, Mr. Girk. Please, give us the forsaken objects. We'll take them back to the Danes on our way back to Oklahoma.
Girk's eyes went to his cousin, seeking answers. Now the cousin seemed to be wavering. He wiped his hands on his pant legs. It wasn't the first time Ben had seen him do it.
Look, lady, Girk said, I'm real sorry that...
She interrupted him, a bit of fire in her voice for the first time.
No, you look. This is what those cursed belongings did to me.
She unsnapped the right side of her veil and lifted it up. Ben couldn't see from where he stood inside the doorway, but Dallas Girk saw. He reeled. His back hit the wall so hard the big cross shook on the mantel.
Oh, God,
he mumbled, putting a filthy handkerchief to his mouth. Ben strained to see Lorelei's face, but she was already replacing the veil.
What is it, Dal?
The cousin asked from the kitchen, his vantage point being no better than Benny's.
Get the wood crate, Aloysius,
Girk said, then gagged. He actually gagged.
Oh, Lord,
Lorelei wailed.
It may be too late, sir.
Ben watched in wonder as the two cousins filled the crate with items from Ben's list, even though Girk looked ready to fall on his face at any minute. He just marveled that this was happening, only closing his mouth when he said,
The music box. Oh, yes,
Lorelei agreed loudly.
That witch-cursed music box. You do not want to be here when it plays.
I heard it play,
the cousin exclaimed. I didn't know.
He took off like a battlefield runner into a back room and came back with an ornate jewelry box. He held it out to his cousin like it was a dead skunk. A moment later, Lorelei was carting the big crate out the front door.
God bless you, Mr. Girk. If this is everything, you should be feeling better within the hour. You'll see.
It's everything,
he whispered. Then he began coughing, violently now from the exertion. His cousin, Aloysius, apparently, came outside with them, closing the door on his hacking, gasping relative.
Them foreigners, they's witches then?
Oh, no, not the Jespersons,
Lorelei insisted.
A more godly people you'll never see. But it's their calling, their
burden to guard those witch-cursed items, to make sure they're only ever used by the bloodline, and for God's work.
My cousin didn't mean no harm, missus, the cowboy said, helping them tie the big crate to Ben's pony.
He didn't know about no curse. I'm sure he didn't. I only pray he gets better and tries to turn his life around in the days he has left.
Yeah, yeah, said the cowboy, seemingly converted.
Me too. God bless you, sir, said Lorelei,
as she helped Ben up on her horse and mounted behind him.
You too, lady, and boy. Thanks,
Ben said, and they started moving.
Come on, pony,
he said, and the horse obeyed. They were crossing the prairie when Lorelei said,
Okay, you can look back now.
She angled her horse just a bit. Ben did. No one was following.
How did you know that would work?
He asked, still stunned.
I didn't.
She patted the pistol that had been hidden under her duster.
I expected I'd have to let Mr. Colt do the persuading.
But Ben understood. To call him impressed was an understatement. Still, he had to know what was wrong with Lorelei's face, what had put the fear of God into Dallas Kirk.
What's on your mind?
She asked into his ear. She was a mentalist too, it seemed. Another subject for the pulp magazines.
I was wondering,
he began, but couldn't follow through.
What you're going to take as a reward? Between the candlesticks and music box? Well, I was thinking I'd make good use of a Bible written in Danish,
she said, making it sound like something she'd always dreamt of.
Really?
He asked, surprised at her choice.
No, kid.
Ben rode the next few minutes in silence. They both did. 12. Once again, they smelled the pig farm long before they reached it. Ben was now wrestling with the question of whether it was right to take one of the religious items from the Jesperson family, and whether Jerome Cook would have done so or not, were he here. The foreign couple were overjoyed to have the items returned. They cried, and Mrs. Jesperson hugged both of them tightly. Apparently, tak venner was the Danish word for thank you. Ben couldn't help but think of being at the orphanage, when a family would come for a child, and wondered if he'd like to grow up surrounded by hogs and speaking Denmark. There was some irony, he thought, when Stig Jesperson asked them to thank the lean rider for them. But Scruggs said she would. When it came time for the reward, Lorelei chose neither the candlestick nor the music box, nor the Bible, but said she would be happy with some roast pork or bacon. That felt to Ben what the writer might have done in that situation, though the stories always had him make a speech about how justice was its own reward, and if they did a good turn for someone else, it would make them square. They walked out of the ramshackle homestead side by side, and both of them patted their horses on the nose. Ben looked toward where the Girk homestead lay, far on the horizon.
Do you think that cowboy would come here again, looking for revenge?
Revenge? Repeated Lorelei.
I doubt it. Either he'll get better and be too grateful, or...
Or? Ben asked.
Or he won't get better, in which case he'll still leave them alone.
Ben nodded. He felt proud. He was pretty sure this is what life as the lean rider's sidekick would have been every day. And he felt something for the woman beside him, a combination of admiration for how she had managed to accomplish their mission without violence, and an affection for another person who cared about his future. It was different from what he felt toward the monjas in habits and stern faces at San Domingo's, for that had been a combination of fear, awe, and a little hate.
What's that look for?
Lorelei asked in front of him, her unwatchable face watching his.
Just happy is all,
Ben said. And he was. They traveled west again, toward Torino.
Lorelei had him go through various phrases in Spanish, helping her understand the difference between masculine words and feminine ones, of how you changed a word to make it past or future tense, or to mean you, or we, or them. It amused Ben how much she struggled, for Espanol had never been his strong suit, yet he was an expert compared to her. She had him practice shooting once more before they reached his little Arizona town, and he managed to wing a buzzard sitting on a Joshua tree with the rifle. But it was still able to take flight and head for the distant hills.
"If you have one cartridge and you're hungry," she said, "you'll have to do better than that."
"I will," Ben promised. "I just need to keep practicing."
She nodded.
"And who's going to pay for all your practice bullets?"
"I'll pay for them myself, with my share of the reward meat."
She laughed at that. It was a young sound, a girlish sound, and he longed to hear it again, all the time. They returned to Trueno and found nothing changed. One of the saloons had gotten a piano that played by itself, though it only knew two songs. A couple more letters had arrived, and Ms. Aubrey wanted her rent money and the woman's, though they hadn't used their rooms in days. Ben did his laundry and practiced knot tying and lassoing, even though this hadn't been part of Lorelei's training, while it soaked. He saw Sheriff Murtry as he walked into the general store, and the man paused, looking like he was going to approach him, but only tipped his hat and kept walking. Lorelei was gone for a day, saying she needed to do something on her own, and Ben went to school that day, distracted, worrying she might not come back. But she had left her belongings in Ms. Aubrey's place, including what she claimed to be 2 gold doubloons from the old days of explorers from Spain. She would be back. Ben found himself delighting at the prospect. He had to write a composition on the Founding Fathers and found it hard to concentrate, even though Ben knew more about the beginnings of America than anyone save the teacher. Lizard Ortiz, whose actual first name was Lisandro, asked where he had gone for those days and commented that Benny had sunburned his nose. Ben told him they were doing work for the Lean Rider, and Lizard asked,
"What's he like?"
Ben thought back.
"Tall, kind of rough and mean-looking, but not scary, just strong.
If he ever needs another boy, could I come along?"
Ben told him he'd mention it, but he probably wouldn't see the man for a while. Some of the boys had gotten hold of 2 Lean Rider adventures, written up by Corbin St. Clair, a journalist who used too many big words. Ben had read and reread one of the tales, The Lean Rider versus the Grizzly People, and wondered about the stories he might have been a part of, if not for The Lean Rider and the Drunk's Lucky Shot adventure just that year.
All right, folks, that's where we're going to stop for this episode. This is the second part of a sidekick's journey from the Sidekick Chronicles. I guess I should have said that during my silly spiel with the cowboy speaking person. Maybe I'll put that in right now. Now I wish I hadn't said it. So that's where we ended this episode. It feels kind of like a natural stopping point. And gosh, I hate to do this to you, but I think we are going to stop there. The thing is, I have these other episodes that are already edited and ready to go, but they're just sitting. And one of them, I wish that I'd gotten it out in July. Well, I mean, it's not timely, but, well, I'll tell you what. I'm going to run either that episode or 2 episodes that are just sitting, that are done, that are ready to go, that are not continuations of a sidekick's journey next. And then we're going to pick up with the rest of Sidekick's journey after that. And if that pisses you off, I'm sorry. I really wrestled with it in my head of how I would do this. And when I was editing, this episode, actually, I thought, you know, this feels like a place where the story... Well, the first one, where I ended it with Ben lying awake scared at night, that could be the end of a story, too. And so I just felt like maybe this is a good place to take a break because they just had an adventure together and it went well. And you could say the end after this point and people would be like, oh, well, that's kind of nice. So that's what we're going to do. And yeah, feel free to be angry if you'd like in the comments. I like comments. But I haven't edited the next Sidekicks Journey episodes, but I have edited these other ones. And so it just seems like rather than delay or rather than have these other ones have to wait until September or October, why not just put them out right now? We'll come back to a Sidekicks Journey in just a couple weeks. Sorry, I that's the decision I've made. Sometimes these things are arbitrary. I hope you understand. I hope you have enjoyed what you've heard so far. I hate to say this to you, but if you want to go out and buy a Sidekicks Journey to find out what happens next, feel free. That'd be great. Yeah, that's all I got to say about that. All right. I'm really going to try to get these out on a regular schedule so that we've got like a month Ben Parks episodes, and then after that we go on to regular. But I don't know, but that's super doable. We'll see. Anyhow, the last time I did a lengthy story, long enough to where I broke it up on the show, it was The Brown Prom, which was a story that I broke up into three pieces and then realized that I just repeated the same stuff in the third piece, and so I ended up just having it over two episodes. I don't want to replicate that. I don't want to repeat the same information, the same stories. So I want to record all four of these at the same time. And the disadvantage of that is that I might be tired, that there are things that will come to mind later that I'll wish that I had mentioned or put in here. And there's nothing saying that I can't put in stuff later. I do that all the time. So let's see. I should have made notes. Of course, I'm driving, so the notes would have just been deadly. Okay, so first thing I want to talk to you about is the first story, is Birth of a Sidekick. I was living in Los Angeles. I had a job I think about all the time, that was not far from where I lived, and it paid the bills, and I had some good friends that I worked with. There was always downtime every single day at work. So that was time to write if I wanted it. And so I mostly wrote Birth of a Sidekick at work, you know, like an hour before it was time to go home, half hour, something like that. And as soon as I was done, before I did any revising or polishing or anything like that, I sent it to Big Anklevich. And he and I had been corresponding a great deal once I moved to LA and he moved back to Sacramento. And we became much closer friends through emails than we ever had been when we went to school together. I mean, it was pretty hard to pull him off the co-eds long enough to have a conversation with him in those days. And so I guess it's understandable that we weren't particularly close in college. But I sent him this, and he emailed me back, and I guess he'd read it at work, and he thought that it was really, really good. And he said something that was super complimentary to me, which I'm afraid to say here on the air because it will make me sound like a douche. But you know what? Douche I am. He said, I've been reading my wife's James Patterson mystery novels, and I think you're a better writer than he is. Now, that really surprised me. I had never read any James Patterson. It wouldn't be for a couple years until I'd start to hear people criticize him as not being that good of a writer. But that did wonders for my self-esteem to hear Big say that. Usually, you know where I'm coming from. You remember the nasty things that people say to you and you forget the compliments. But this is a compliment that I never forgot. It was nice. I appreciated him saying that for me, to me. And then we continued to correspond. And then not long after that, I lost my job. Pretty soon I didn't have any money. I had to move away. But we started seeing each other, Big and I, all the time. And we started to make an effort to be writers. Not a serious effort, but an effort nevertheless. And I'm recording this right now a year after Big has moved away, so I haven't seen him in a year. But the last few months before we parted ways, we had this idea of going somewhere together and then writing separately. And then once we had written X number of words or X number of minutes had passed, then we could chat and we could hang out as we always did on Monday nights. And we didn't do that for a very long time. Probably like 2 or 3 months where we'd do the writing thing. And sometimes we wouldn't feel like it. Sometimes Big would start the timer and I'd be like, whoa, you got to pause it. There's something I want to say. And that was fun. But I was just thinking about that last night of how I wish that we had continued that, how I wish that we had done that for years. Think of all the writing I would have gotten done where you're someplace, sat down and focused and you're forced to write. Do you know what I'm saying? Anyhow, that was over a year ago now. But Birth of a Sidekick was 2005. So a few years later, I was really focused, really trying to be a writer, a published writer. And so I self-published Birth of a Sidekick and did my own audiobook of it. And with that in mind, while I was editing, I started thinking about, you know, what happened to Ben Parks afterward, because I never had any intention of writing a follow-up to this story. The first one ends with, you know, it turned out that Ben himself became a famous lawman and he righted a lot of wrongs and he became almost as famous as the Lean Rider himself. Something like that at the very, very end of that first story. It's, you know, it's sort of showing you, it's the end of Animal House, showing you what happened to all these characters later. Or American Graffiti is probably a better example, because they eventually did make a sequel to American Graffiti. And in one character's case where they explained that they had died, they thought, oh, shoot, how do we fix this? We want this character to go in a different direction. So a decade after I wrote Birth of a Sidekick, I thought, okay, I'm going to write a sequel to that story. And I've told you this before, I think. It was going to take place immediately after Birth of a Sidekick. And Ben was going to be there still trying to figure out what to do with himself. And a guy was going to come into town, a newspaper man, who wanted to interview the Lean Rider. And Ben was going to have to come up with excuses as to why the Lean Rider couldn't give any interviews. It was going to be a light little story. It was going to be a short story. And in the back of my mind, I wish that I had written that first, because I like that idea of doing a novella and then a short story and then a novella and a short story. And eventually they could all be collected as part of one very large collection called The Sidekick Chronicles. But as of this time in 2018, I still haven't written that story. I referred to the events in that story in something that I was writing right now, so that when I go back and I write that story that takes place right after Birth of a Sidekick, it'll all feel like it was meant to be. Hopefully, it'll all feel like it's meant to be. Shoot, there's a name for what the pulp writers used to write short stories that were about the same characters. and then they would collect them in books that they called, there was a word for it, a skip book or a something book, where it was just the short stories collected, and sometimes they would write little bridging parts to make it seem like a novel instead of a collection of short stories. Because even then, I suppose, novels sold better than short story collections. I went to a panel at a writer's conference where they were talking about conflict and putting obstacles in the path of your character, and that I'm not going to say enables it. Okay, well, we'll just say enables your reader to root for the character, to empathize with the character, to feel what the character is feeling. And if they have a really hard time, then that hooks your reader. That gets your reader emotionally invested. And I started thinking about Ben Parks and, like, what kind of bad things could happen to Ben Parks, because in that story that I had come up with, it looked like things were going pretty well for him. And so I decided to take some of those things away. And because he's a kid, things tend to happen to Ben Parks rather than him being one of those active characters that goes out and seeks adventure, that makes discoveries on his own. But who knows how many of these I will write and how old he will end up by the time I finish, because I think it would be an interesting journey from wide-eyed, innocent child to the guy that sees that something needs to be done and he does it, that looks for things that need doing. I kind of felt like that's how the Lean Rider was. People would write to him and say, hey, I have this problem, can you fix it? But in the meantime, when in between those times, he would go looking for trouble. He would find... It's very episodic. His adventures were like Cain in Kung Fu, or like the Lone Ranger, or, you know, something like that. Like David Banner on the Incredible Hulk television series, where you just go from town to town and there are wrongs that need righting. And then you move to the next town after that. And I like the idea of writing a series like that. Lee Child has the series, the Jack Reacher series, and I get the impression that each of those books is like that. The Jack Reacher comes into a town and meets some new characters, makes some new enemies, helps some people, and then he moves on. Boy, I don't know that I have a ton of things to say. Like I said in the last episode, I was really surprised by how long a sidekick's journey was. When I made the decision to run it on the show, I thought, well, I think I ran Birth of a Sidekick in either 3 or 4 parts, and that was one more part than I originally was going to run it as. And so I thought, well, I can do the same with this, but Sidekick's Journey is more than twice the length of Birth of a Sidekick. So I could keep these statements short and the episodes would still be long. So maybe I will. One little thing maybe I should have said in the last episode. I used the N-word in the story, and as I was writing it, I sort of went back and forth on whether I would use that particular word, because in 2015, 2016, it had become the most despised, the most vilified word in the English language. And yet, in the era in which this story takes place, I don't think it would have that particular onus, and it also would have been so much more common. And I was playing with the idea of the people of Troino mistreating the black man that came into town. You know, at least just throwing in a couple of lines, you know, kind of the beginning of Forrest Gump with that, the crappy little kids say, you can't sit here, this seat's taken. at least that kind of prejudice. And ultimately, it just... it's not that I tiptoed around it. I just didn't include him interacting with pretty much anybody. And then I had that word used by the character. And that guy, he doesn't do a lot in this story. But I, in the back of my mind, anybody who's not killed is still out there to show up again in a future story, if I end up writing a dozen of these. And it would be great if I could. It would be great if I could write a dozen stories, guys, but I seem to have reverted to my earlier ways of being physically incapable of finishing a story once I start it. It's sad. It's embarrassing. But that is the case. So, yeah, that character is still out there. At least one other character from this story is still out there to write future stories about. And I think we talked about this when I first presented that Journey of a Sidekick was available to buy. I mentioned, you know, that 10 years had passed in between writing the first story and the second story, but yet Ben was still the same age. And that floored me, just that idea that these characters are effectively immortal. Like, if I wrote 10 more of these and then I died and somebody else picked up the series, Ben Parks could be like 14 in 2050. That to me is just amazing. The magic of storytelling. I mean, there's way more magic than that, right? But that idea that I could write something next year that takes place before the story I'm presenting to you guys right now. And why wouldn't I? It's exciting. I've not ever been somebody who could write a series. And the idea of having a group of characters that you catch up with again and again and develop their relationships and stuff, it just, there is something really attractive about that. But it's slow going, as you know. Oh, and if I still have you right now, I want to say this. I, in between hitting stop and hitting record again 2 minutes ago, I thought, okay, I really appreciate the people that support me on Patreon, that give me money for my episodes. I'm going to give them something. And so on one of these, probably the third or fourth episode of A Sidekick's Journey, I'm going to share an excerpt from the newest Ben Parks story. I Just Missed My Exit. Called I Just Missed My Exit. Guys, it's really hard to concentrate on driving and podcasting at the same time. You wouldn't think so, because it's just like talking on the phone. But how many accidents have people been into because they're really engaged in a telephone conversation? They're really focused. Lots. And I hear other people do this where they're driving and they lose track of what they're saying, or they'll start to say something and then they forget and they never pick it up again. And I totally understand. Now I have to go all the way to the next exit, turn around, because I needed to go to the post office. And I was seriously within walking distance of the post office when I missed my exit. Just great. And by great, I mean the opposite. Let me go back. So either in episode 3 or episode 4 of Journey's Sidekick, I'm going to share an excerpt from the Ben Parks story that I'm writing right now. And I don't know if that's going to motivate you to go and give me a couple bucks, but the fact of the matter is, ever since I started my Patreon, this show has been more of a priority, and I've put out more episodes in the year that I've had that Patreon fund than I put out in the years, all the years put together before. So it's definitely a motivator to put out more episodes. And if you like this show, you like my voice, you like my sense of humor or my writing, then go support me, please. I don't have a lot of supporters, and so I'm able to appreciate every single one. And it's funny. There's a character. She's not a major character in this Ben Parks story I'm writing right now, but she's significant enough that I think she will be mentioned in future stories. And she doesn't have a name. And so I was going to post to my Patreon people, give me a name. I need the name of a girl that Ben meets that makes an impact on his life. So, okay, this was the episode I was telling you was going to be short. I mean, if you look at the time code, it's not been short at all. But my comments are going to be short, shorter on this one than all the others. And if I hadn't missed my exit, I would have already signed off. So here I am. I'm turning around to go all the way back to where I needed to go. Oh, and you hear that? Americana by Kevin MacLeod. Yeah, I really appreciate this little piece of music. I don't know why. I mean, it's not supposed to be a Western theme or anything like that. And I've heard other people use it, like, on their YouTube videos. And I always feel like it belongs to me. It's like, hey, you're using that about space exploration? No, this is a Wild West story. And yeah, even though it's called Americana, you could write a story that takes place in Egypt or Brazil or Sri Lanka or Vermont, and you could use that music and it would work because it's just so good. I'm going to let you go now, but thank you again for listening, and thank you for supporting me, whether it's just in not turning the episode off yet, coming back for the next one, or whether it's, you know, with money. You are appreciated. I will be back very soon with more of Journey of a Sidekick. A Sidekick's Journey. I did it to myself there, didn't I? And until then, make sure you have your hat on tight. Good night.
I cannot believe it has come to this. The Rish Outcast has always been presented under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial License. And yet look at what you've done with it. It was not to be sold, not to be hacked apart, and not to be claimed by anyone except the original benighted podcaster. You might have gone so far, even to supporting young Outfield with his foolhardy Patreon account schemes. But no! I trusted you, loved you, and how have you betrayed me?
First thing, I should have mentioned this in the last episode, that I used the N-word in the story. And there was actually a... Do I want to do that first? Like it's the most important thing? It isn't. Let's go back.
From my book, Surcease of Sorrow. Sorrow for the loss of Lenore. Sorrow for the lost Lenore. For the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lamore. For the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore. Perched upon a bust of Pallas just above. Perched upon a bust of Pallas just above my chamber door. Wretch, I cried, thy God hath lent thee, by these angels he hath sent thee. Wretch, I cried, thy God hath lent thee. I can't do it. Thy God hath lent thee. Then this ebony bird beguiling my sad fancy into smiling, startled, startled at the stillness, broken by reply. Wait, startled at the stillness broken by reply so aptly. Startled at the stillness broken by reply so aptly spoken. And the raven, never flitting, still is shitting, still is shitting, on the pallid bust of Palish, just above my chamber door. And his eyes have all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming, and the lamplight o'er him streaming throws his shadow on the floor. And my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor shall be lifted nevermore.